I just wanted y'all to know I got a watch. You didn't have one to come here. I don't care what time it is. And I would like for you to pay particular attention to what's going on up here this morning, because we're going to have a test after this is over. Sally mentioned my wife, and she was asking me the other night, says, you know, combined we have 62 years of sobriety. And I thought, well, so we got 62 years of sobriety. Anyhow, I'm going to get up and say hello to the folks so we can get that over with. And couple of things I like to get out of my claw before I get started. And one of them is I've met an awful lot of you and have certainly enjoyed this weekend. Alverna says, them people don't do nothing but eat up there. And I said, well. But anyhow, I'd like to meet some more of you and hope I do before we can get clear of this place today. And when you do, please, my name's James or my name's Patrick or Jane or whatever it is, and I'm an alcoholic. Because if you do any more than that, you cause me much distress in the lower track, and I know you don't want that to happen to me this morning. So I tell you, though, when that happens, what happens with me anyhow, when you say my name's John or Patrick or whatever it is and I'm an alcoholic, I immediately establish something with you. I know that you've been to that place of loneliness, of broken dreams, that street where things just don't seem to work right and where life don't seem to be going right and all. But if you add something to that, something goes off up here. Al Vernon says I'm ignorant and biased and prejudiced, and that's probably true. But after that, I don't know who I'm talking to. I don't make that same connection as I do when I'm John and I'm an alcoholic. So please, if we get an opportunity to meet, I'm John and I'm an alcoholic, and I'd certainly appreciate that. The other thing is that we got a lot of young people, and boy, I'm delighted with that, because when I came in, they called me boy. And that's 44 years old then. In any event, sometimes these conventions and get-togethers can get a little confusing, because one speaker says this and the next one gets up and says something else and so forth and so on. And so I went to a sponsor right after this had happened to me several times, and I was absolutely baffled by all this stuff that was going on and a lot of new words and all that sort of thing. And I asked him about it, and he said, well, let me explain it to you this way, dummy. It would be like if you were going to the University of Ohio and taking Biology 101. That professor would have a certain presentation and all that sort of thing, and he'd probably present his program like he had been taught to do, or how he had received it from his teachers or whatever. He might require a test, or he might have a daily quiz or paper or whatever. Who knows? But if you went down to Texas and enlisted in a university down there and went to Biology 101, that guy might have a little different presentation. But he's still teaching Biology 101. And that's the way it is with speakers. We're all going up the same path. It's just a little different stroke and a stroll as we go along the way. So don't be confused by all this. Pretty soon it'll all come together. Sometimes. The other thing is that I'm rather sick of us old graybeards running around running our mouth at these programs. And I'd like to see some younger people up here, and especially younger women. We certainly need you on this hot dog circuit it is. And I know you say, oh, I couldn't ever get up in front of a bunch of people and all that sort of thing. Well, most of us, I'm quite sure, felt that way at one time or another. But you got to remember a couple of things, and it's really simple. It really is. And the first thing about it is, you know the subject matter. You know you better than anybody else. I'm not saying you might know the big book better than anybody else, but you know you better than anybody else. And the second thing is, we're very kind in AA to speakers. Very benevolent group. And if you think not, they call us the nodders, you know. If you've ever been to a meeting, you know, and maybe somebody said something, you'd say, I don't think I'd have said that. But if you look around, somebody would be going. I know that's true, because I was up the Central Group in Orlando one time at a meeting. A socialite friend of mine from Washington was sitting next to me. And some lady was visiting. It was a discussion meeting. And this lady that was visiting said something about she peed in her purse. And I said, I don't think I'd have said that. And I looked around the room and looked over here, and here was Peggy going. So you pick you out a knotter. And I already got two or three of them out there now, see? Yeah. And you just go on and talk to that knotter. Two other things that are terribly important to know when you're through. Somebody probably back there saying you're through now, Oakley, but anyhow. Yeah, when you make your first talk or two, why, if you don't talk for 30 minutes, that's okay. Quit at 30 minutes, and we'll be glad. We'll clap for you and everything else, you know. But if you only got a 30-minute talk, don't make it an hour, you know. And the other final thing is, go to the bathroom before you get up here. Because I don't care if you just went, you know. Invariably, when you get up here, something happens biologically, physiologically, or something. And pretty soon, you're thinking about going about to the bathroom instead of telling me your story. But anyhow, please consider that. Really. One final thing, and then I'll get drunk and undrunk or whatever I want to do up here this morning. It's been mentioned several times during this convention. I'm one of these people that believes that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't be near the program it is today without the program of Al-Anon. That's enough. Don't ever give an Al-Anon or a New Men too many of those pats on the back or anything. That didn't work at all. My name is Bill Oakley. I am an alcoholic. Thank you. And I belong to the Narcoosie, no name group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if you've ever been in Narcoosie, you're lost. But people just don't go there. It's got a blinking light. That's about the only thing it tells you in Narcoosie. Really, there's no population. We don't even have a zip code. We use one from St. Cloud. But we meet on Monday and Thursday night, and that's just about the best damn group in the country. Now, if you don't think yours is the best group in the country, don't come down there and screw ours up. You stay up here and make yours the best. And I think everybody ought to feel that way about their home group. I think everybody ought to have a home group. I'm quite sure everybody out here does, though. So I guess I better get started here somewhere this morning. I was raised in a little town in Lexington, Kentucky. It wasn't 65,000-70,000 people, I imagine, at the time. Anyhow, I was a very poor student because I never had the ability to ask anybody, did I do this right? Is this what you meant? Can you explain this to me? That was never within Bill Oakley. From the time he entered school, I couldn't do that. So naturally, as a very poor student, times were tough. I lived with poor people. I didn't know it at the time because everybody around was just as poor as we were. Kids would get out on the street after what they called supper, and somebody would say, what'd you have for supper? He'd say, taters. And he didn't say taters and either. He just said taters. And so everybody was poor, and I was a long time realizing that, because like I say, the whole neighborhood was about in the same shape. So anyhow, being the poor student, living in a family that was rather destitute for any kind of financial support they could get, it was determined that I might as well quit school, because I wasn't doing any good there, and maybe I could find some kind of little old ratty job and make some kind of financial contribution to this rather destitute family. So sure enough, I lived on the outskirts of the city at that time, not in the county, but on the outskirts, and a local stockyard was just less than a quarter of a mile away. And so I went up there, and sure enough, the old boy hired me, and he put me on the hog scales. And I never had been around stock at that time. And like I say, it was December in Kentucky. That can be a miserable place, like Washington, D.C. at that time. It was just miserable. And, of course, I was ill-shod and clothed for that kind of work, and cold and miserable, and I didn't know anything about hogs, and they gave me a cane, and I was supposed to open this gate and let them in and close the gate, and they'd let them off over there and then open it again, you know. And I was just absolutely miserable, you know, and cold and standing in that awful stuff. You know, hogs, mostly when they're at home, they got a little place they'll go and take care of things. But when you get them out there in the wild like that, and you're beating them with canes and whistling at them and everything, you know, they go often, I'm telling you, and they don't care where they go. And there I was standing in that nasty stuff and everything with those cheap shoes I had, and I was cold and miserable, like I say. This old farmer came over and he reached down in them bib overalls and he pulled out a bottle of red liquor, so it was store liquor. And he says, "Here, boy, take yourself a drink of this and you'll be all right." And I did, and Lord God, did he tell the truth. Lord, did he tell the truth. I took a drink. It didn't just tingle a little bit. It went to every part of my body. My fingertips even felt it, you know. I didn't give a damn what I was standing in anymore. Next hog that came by, I took that cane, just knocked the hell out of him, just showing him I'd do it. I had 10 cents in my pocket. 10 cents in my pocket became $10. I didn't have any fear anymore. And the final thing was, I became prettier. I knew I was prettier. And my golden moment was born. The golden moment that I was chased for the next 25 or 30 years of my life. Always trying to recapture that time when I wasn't filled with fear, when I wasn't cold and miserable, when 10 cents became $10, and I knew I was prettier. Always trying to recapture that time, but never able to. But from that time on, when that golden moment came to Bill Oakley's mind, he was destined to drink. Don't tell me about consequences. That had nothing to do with it. When that golden moment came onto my mind, I would drink. Job, I'd leave it. It didn't make any difference. With war going on, that had nothing to do with it. I would always drink on that golden moment, which, like most alcoholics, and I'm going to establish this right quickly, we always drink on a lie. You can take that one to the bank. And, of course, my golden moment was a lie, too. I was trying to get into the Army. The war was going on, and of course, in World War II, it was appropriate that if you were a young man walking around and had two eyes and two arms and two legs, you was expected to be in the military. Well, I am blind in one eye, and I had a problem. They just wouldn't take me. But finally, the bulge came along, and they sort of lessened the restrictions on the physical conditions, and they took me into the Army. And I went into armored infantry. And the golden moment didn't bother me a lot right then. I don't know whether it was the regimentation, the newness of it, or what it was, but it didn't, the golden moment didn't come on a lot during that time in the Army. I learned one thing while I was in the Army, though. I didn't want to be all I could be. No. And right after the war was over, about a year and a half later, why, they'd gotten the High Point people out, and they got down to people like me, and they asked me if I wanted out, and I said yes. I spent the next 5 years on the major skids on the East Coast. Not all of them, but enough of them to know what the skids are like. I woke up in Detroit in a car one time. I don't know whose car it was. Didn't know it was Detroit for sure. But I looked up, and I saw a sign, and there's Uncle Sam pointing that finger at you and says, "He wants you, you know." And so I remember talking to a bunch of winos the night before about the Korean War, which was just kicking in real good about then. And so laying in that car without any money and not knowing where I was at, being sick and everything else, I thought, well, it'd be my patriotic duty to go into the military again. I know now patriotism didn't have much to do with it. In any event, I went down and had that, like I say, that previous experience in the Army. So I smartened up enough this time. I went in the Air Force. And they didn't bother to give me any physical because I had this background of the Army and all. They just took me right on in. They were hard up pressed for people at that time, too. The only thing is I took that golden moment into the military with me. And that certainly reflected during the Korean War. I made 11 stripes during that war and kept 4 of them. So you can see every time the golden moment came on, I would get reduced, of course. And then I would go into my periods of what I called self-imposed sobriety. I'd do the work probably better than most of them because I wanted to make up for that time where I'd screwed up, you know. And sure enough, they gave you a stripe back. 6 months later, the golden moment would come on. I get busted again. I even got busted on a boat going over there, trying to make wine. Then anyhow, Korean War's over. I'm 27 years old and a full-blown alcoholic because I'm a blackout drinker. Now, if you're in question about your alcoholism and you're a blackout drinker, you is. You don't need to have to worry about it. And that was my status. But the committee got together up here and said, Oakley, you know something's wrong with your life. Says, you something's missing. You need something else in your life. And I ran over it, and finally it came up here like a light bulb or something, you know. You need to get married. Why in God's name an alcoholic thinks he needs to get married, I don't know. Unless it's recovery through sex or something like that. God, what in the world can I possibly bring to a marriage? Anyhow, I found a little old dumb girl down there in Kentucky, and she had to be dumb to marry me. Anyhow, she had two wee children, and we got married and went out there to Moses Hole, Washington. And again, the golden moment didn't bother me there for a little while. It might have been the newness of that or the regimentation, I don't know. But anyhow, the golden moment didn't bother me. That enlistment was up. And I was to re-enlist, and I made application for different places in the country. And one of them was Miami International Airport on 36th Street. And lo and behold, I got it. It was a stabilized tour of 3 years, 216 of us down there. And every one of them alcoholic that I knew, including the chaplain. We had to throw him out of the NCO club. He was so bad. But that was to be my next assignment. Well, the newly acquired wife went to Kentucky, to a place called Georgetown. And a daughter was to be born to that union. And I went on down to Miami. Well, you can imagine the Miami and being in Miami and being alcoholic. And only having to work 2 days a month. Had to train your reservists 2 days a month. Imperative you show up those 2 days though. And everybody knew it. During the week we'd meet in bars all over the place, the old man and first sergeant and everybody else would play shuffleboard and do this 2 or 3 o'clock. Well, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon we'd head home maybe or go to another bar or something like that. And that was a daily routine. Routine, except those 2 days. Training weekend, you had to be there. I took a bus down in Miami. What was the charge? Failure to repair. That means I didn't show up for work. But you see, that golden moment went to work and he's telling me things like this. Oh, it's only 9 o'clock. You quit at 10 and go and get plenty of sleep and get up in the morning and, you know, start them guys on her. Now, well, 11, that ain't bad. Hell, that's okay, you know. And pretty soon, I'll call in the first thing in the morning. Well, I'll call in about 9:30 and tell them. Anyhow, that bus cost me $55 a month for 6 years. That's what I paid for a drink of liquor one time. But you see, that golden moment told me it was worth it. Well, finally, the wife and children joined me down there, and I finally arranged for a place to live. But I was having a continuous problem with the golden moment. I'm no longer a periodic alcoholic at this particular time in my life. And I needed some more money, too, of course. Alcoholics usually need money. And I took a job, an extra job, tending bar. You know, that always helps. And the wife was very dissatisfied with me most of the time, even from the time she arrived. And one morning I woke up and a kid was shaking me. He says, "Say, Sarge," he says, "your wife's downstairs and she'd like for you to come down." Well, I was in my wardrobe, so I just rolled off of this bed. I don't know when I'd been home last or anything else. But when I got down there on the pavement, I could perfectly obvious what was going on. The car was leveled with baggage and children. And this lovely lady put her head out the window and says, "Bill, we're going to have to go home to Mother." And that golden moment came on, and I said, "Well, have a good trip." And I turned and went to the NCO club to get that first drink of the day. Wasn't any thought of, can there be any reconciliation? I'll try to do better. Do you have enough money? Is the car safe? None of those thoughts entered my head. If they did, they were secondary to the golden moment. And I went and responded to that, of course. And she returned to Kentucky. I needed another assignment. I stayed down there 3.5 years. Damn near killed me. And I made application for another assignment. And I received one with the Security Service, which was mostly linguists, that listen to what's going on in the world. So they stay overseas most of the time. They have some beautiful assignments, you can imagine. In any event, my assignment was out of Crete, right off of the coast of Greece, a few miles. And so I was to leave Carolina and go over there. But I arrived out. They had a small problem with the airplane and in the Bahamas. And they had to sit down for a few minutes. And they told us all to get out off the tarmac over there and go and smoke, but to stay in close vicinity so we could load back on when we needed to. And sure enough, everybody did that. But I walked over there, and I looked up on the hill, and there was a big NCO in red letters. And that golden moment came on, too. And so I just walked up to that club and sat down and started knocking them off, because they were only 10 or 15 cents for a drink. And pretty soon I saw the airplane wheels up, and I enjoyed about 4 or 5 days in Bahama before they could get a seat block and get me out of there. Then I went into the Azores and two countries in North Africa, Sicily, Rome. Finally, one night in Rome, I was standing with a bunch of GIs. I didn't know who in the heck they were, how I come about, or, you know, really didn't know too much about where I was at. And I asked this kid, I said, where in the hell are we? He says, well, we're in Athens. I says, Athens? I says, drunk, I wouldn't go to Athens, Georgia. And he says, Sarge, you don't have to worry about it. You're in Greece. Well, I got out to the island the next day, and they took a very dim view of the fact that I'd taken 18 days getting there from the States, especially when I was supposed to be on an airplane. So, but here's the amazing thing about a drunk, and especially a periodic alcoholic, and those of you who are periodics know exactly what I'm talking about. For the next 18 months, with the keys to the pocket of the NCO club, could have had a drink any time I wanted to, because an additional duty of mine was running the club. Didn't touch a drop. Didn't touch a drop. Imagine what's going on at home. The first 30 days, she says, he's done this before. But then it was maybe 60 days or 90 days. The letters are coming. More money's coming, because I had no reason. I had an additional job, like I say, for running the club. I was paid for it. That money went home, too. I had no need of money. And pretty soon, you can imagine how her letters are coming. My God, she's so excited. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is the time. 6 months went by. A year went by. I remembered all the birthdays. Sent nice gifts. I'd go down on the Gold Street and buy something really worthwhile, you know, and send it to everybody, even my mother-in-law. And so she's really excited. She's elated over this fact that maybe this time he's quit that damn stuff. And sure enough, I got back in the States. Went down to Georgetown, Kentucky, like I say, where we live. Dry County in Georgetown. One car in the family. So I could only get that car early in the morning. And I drive over in Fayette County, where Lexington's at. And that's a wet county. And I'd have just a couple of drinks is all I could get, because they'd need the car for some reason. I had to get it home again. Maybe I'd get it again in the afternoon. Maybe I wouldn't. But anyhow, it wasn't golden moment drinking as far as I was concerned, rather. Just a few little beers or something like that, you know. But imagine, 27 days later, I'm in straps in Shaw Air Force Base, South Carolina. They kept me in straps, I don't know, for a week or so. 2 or 3 weeks in a wheelchair. And another 30 days before they could return me to duty. I thought, what in God's name has happened to me? I've been working out. I hadn't drank in a year and a half. I hadn't done any serious drinking. And here I am in these damn straps again. What on earth is going on? I had to come to you. You told me. The disease progresses in me whether I drink it or not. I'm a firm believer in that, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a firm believer in that. I have no doubt in my mind, if I went downtown here today and started knocking off a few, that I'd be in jail by 4 o'clock. Guarantee you. Guarantee you I'd be in jail by 4 o'clock. It progresses in me whether I drink it or not. So, this continued on. Nothing got any better. Of course, I wasn't doing anything to make it better. The golden moment came on, kept coming on. The assignments. They don't need you in the the states when you're assigned to SS headquarters. You only get about anywhere from 3 to 6 months back in this country. Then they send you out again. I've been drunk in 27 countries. So I go out for another one. The old man even asked me this time where I wanted to go. And I told him I wanted to go to Bremerhaven, that we had a nice outfit up there. And he says, all right, I'm going around the world. When I come back, I'll bring you an assignment. And he came back and he says, I can't get you into Bremerhaven. I can send you to Frankfurt. And I knew where Frankfurt was at and where I'd go. I'd go to the IG Farben building, right on Eckenheim and Landstrasse in downtown Frankfurt. And so I took the assignment. My family accompanied me on this one. And it was a real good assignment. It's a beautiful location. Frankfurt's a nice town and all that sort of thing. She was happy. The kids was happy. I was unhappy. And a friend of mine blew his brains out down in Schreibrücken. And because I was the only one in Europe with the same number and this crypto clearance, why, they sent me down to replace him. It's a hellhole down in Schreibrücken. It's two bridges is what that means, of course, and it's right near the French border. And not a nice part of Germany as far as I was concerned. But I took that golden moment with me. And pretty soon she was pretty upset with me for that, of course. And with the assignment in Germany and the way things were going. But anyhow, I made it through the darn thing, got back to the States, and things don't get any better when you're an alcoholic like I am. And of course, she's dissatisfied, just something terrible, because let's face it, when you're an active alcoholic, there ain't no love in it. Uh-uh. You can take that one to the bank too. The love's for the addiction. That comes first. Love follows that. You might think you love your wife and all that sort of thing, but if you're an active alcohol, I'll guarantee you the alcohol will come before the love, unless you do something about it. So anyhow, we're back in the States and going again and all that sort of thing, and it's sort of crazy, and I'm getting crazier. I remember one time, this is even before Germany, I guess, I was so crazy, I took back some things I didn't even steal. When you get in that shape, you're in bad shape. And people tell me what they drank. I think I drank everything you can possibly think of. In fact, I drank some stuff in Turkey. They called it a raki, and it's made from mare's milk. Now, wake up on a good wine hangover and take a shot of that stuff, and by God, I'll tell you, you'll be trying to find your toenails before it's over with. Lord, Lord. Anyhow, things kept going that way. We finally end up in, I'm signed down in Florida or somewhere, and things aren't going any better. And this is some of my insanity I can certainly offer you. I volunteered for Vietnam. And at this time, I didn't have but a couple of years to do, you know, for retirement. And I certainly needed to retire, I'll tell you that. But anyhow, they sent me to Nam. They graciously answered my request to go, and so I got over there though, and that golden moment followed me, and I went into one of the funny palaces over there. Only they were serious over there, real serious. And Charlie started sending in some stuff just about the second or third day I was there, I guess. And these kids were going crazy. They brought them in out of the hills and every place, you know, and they were trying to put them in jackets, trying to get needles in them, trying to strap them to beds. They were doing everything with them. And I woke up about that time, or came to, and I says, good God, what am I doing in here? And there's a male nurse there. He was in charge of nurses. I guess he saw him bring me in because he says, you belong here, buddy. You belong here. And sure enough, I did. I got out of that thing, though, and finally got through with Nam and everything and came home. And they assigned me to Selfridge Air Force Base in Michigan for my final few months. And the golden moment is really bothering me now. And I report one. I didn't report. I went down to my office one morning, rather shaky, you know, and my face is just beet red at this time. And one of the kids that worked for me says, old man wants to see you, Oakley. And I says, okay. So I went up to the old man's office. I knew this colonel, had worked for him before. And he was a man of his word. If he told you, by God, he's going to do something, this is a rarity in the military. But anyhow, this guy told you he's going to do something, he'd do it. So anyhow, I walked in there and went into his secretary's office there, and she says, he's waiting for you, Oakley. I said, okay. So I walked in there and threw him that rather shaky highball, you know, which he didn't appreciate worth a darn. And he started chewing me out, and he chewed real good, real good. And his final words to me were, Sergeant Oakley, I want you to go down there and run that outfit like a sergeant in the United States Air Force. And if you don't do it, I'll jerk those stripes off your arm and kick you out of this man's Air Force. You understand me? And, of course, he knew how short I was. I only had a few months to do it that particular time. And I told him, yes, that I did understand him. I threw him that highball again, which he didn't like, and went out through his secretary's office there and put on my hat. And that golden moment came on, and I jumped in that old truck and drove off of that base to a bar to drink, just as if that man hadn't spoken to me. And I knew full well if he caught me drunk, he'd kick me out of the Air Force. But I was willing to give 19 years and nine, or whatever it was at that particular time, to answer the demands of that golden moment. All that service and everything I was willing to give up for one drink of alcohol. Finally retired just a few months later. It takes at least a minimum of 20 years in the military, as probably most of you know. I had exactly 20 years and 12 days. And if they needed 14 days, I wouldn't have made it. But anyhow, I did. And I went on down to Kentucky. In the interim, why, this little dumb girl I had married 16 years previously, she smarted up and divorced me. And now, see, I was right where an alcoholic wants to be. I want to be free, you know. I don't want any connection with her. I don't have the damn military anymore to put up with. I don't have this. I don't got it now. The only trouble is I pick up a drink and I'm in bondage. There's no freedom for me as long as I'm an alcoholic. I came to Orlando, went into one of my periods of self-imposed sobriety again. A lot of times I got sober in the back of a cruiser, too. I've been in a couple of jails or two. In fact, quite a few. And anyhow, went in one of my periods of self-imposed sobriety, went to work, put some money in the bank, had a little retirement check coming and all that sort of thing. Things were going pretty good. And finally, I stopped at a little bar down on the corner and asked for a glass of beer. And down there, they gave you a glass of beer, but hell, it had 2 inches of collar on it. There wouldn't be enough beer there to, you know, do much at all. Anyhow, I drank it down, you know, and the guy says, you want any more? And I said, no, that's enough. And I wanted everybody in that bar to hear me say, no, that's plenty. Sure enough. Got up the next morning, patting myself on the back. Got it made, Oakley. See there? You drank that beer last night. Didn't drink any more. Came home, fixed your supper, wrote a letter. Sure, boy, you're doing good. Tried it the next night, probably a couple more nights. Finally, it's Friday night, and he goes something like this. I like shooting pool with them old boys. I already seen the landlord. I don't have to pay the rent. Did my laundry yesterday. I can send over next door and get some chicken. I don't know how long that drunk lasts. I really don't. The next thing I'm sure of is I'm in jail. They had what they call an old pea farm out in Orlando at that particular time. They arrested you and they had a small jail downtown. But if you got any time at all, they put you out there on that farm. And they raised most of the stuff they ate and all that sort of thing. And sure enough, that's where I came to. And there was a guy in the pen there with me at that time. And he says, I asked him, right, I says, how long I've been here? He says, 5 days. I says, 5 days? He says, yeah. 5 days just gone out of my life, you know. And for a blackout drinker, that's dangerous as hell. That's dangerous as hell. I've had the opportunity to be up in the state prison in Lowell, Florida, to speak. And them guys line up after you're over with, they say, thank you for coming and all that sort of thing. And they say, yeah, and I was in a blackout and threw out a two-story window. Yeah, I was in a blackout and I tied a rope around her neck and choked her to death. Yeah, I was in a blackout and I did this and that. We even have one record where a doctor went in and performed a C-sectional and didn't know it and came back the next day and raised hell with the staff. And, of course, everybody looked at him like he was crazy. so you can do anything. If you're a blackout drinker, believe me, you're in the most serious place you can be in alcoholism. You say, well, I wouldn't do anything like that. Yeah, that's what a young man that I sponsored said one time. And he killed a man and didn't know anything about it. But he gave the state of Ohio 16 years for doing it anyhow. You can do anything in a blackout. There's a dentist down in Texas who flew a plane from San Antonio up to Oklahoma somewhere and landed in a cornfield. Didn't know nothing about it. Up there flying around. He could have taken your airline out of the clouds for you, for all you know. Huh? Serious place to be. So I gave him 47 days on that drunk charge. Drunk and a couple other things. Lost my license on it, what have you. But this man came. No, we don't want to get ahead of myself there, though. But I finally made up my mind that this booze was causing me some problems. And here's what happened to me. And I think an alcoholic has to arrive at this place before anything else is to follow. I had a little meeting up here. And for once, the committee was sort of in agreement with each other. And there was a little validity in the conversation. And it went something like this. For God's sakes, Bill Oakley, quit telling yourself you can drink alcohol. You can't. It don't make any difference where you drink it, who you drink it with, or what it is. When you drink alcohol, you cause problems. For God's sakes, quit telling yourself that. And I cried out to a God I didn't know anything about. God help me. I never want to be like this again in my life. I don't care what comes down. I don't want to be like this again in my life. Some guy walked up to the jail cell, and he pointed at me. He says, hey, boy, call me boy, I'm 44 years old. Points at me and says, you want to do something about your drinking problem? I said, man, yeah, you know I got a drinking problem. That's the first time I've ever seen him. I reiterated that prayer. God help me, I never want to be like this again. And I started listening to man. I believe that you get a nothing sandwich to you come in contact with it. God help me, I never want to be like this again. But then, this whole beautiful program will open up for you. Thank you, Albert. Anyhow, this... Whew, you threw me way off. But what happened here is that after saying that to this man and listening to him and all, I was given a second golden moment. This one more powerful than the first. This one more powerful than the first. And the whole beautiful program of Alcoholics Anonymous opened up to me. In fact, the book says, once a man admits or willing to admit that he's... How's it go? I don't even remember now. You got me well. Anyhow, we enthusiastically say that he's on his way or whatever. But anyhow, that's what happened to me. I was willing to do something about this thing. I went on and pulled that 47 days, and I was going to get out. I found out I thought I had some money in the bank. I had $700 or $800 when I went on that drunk. Anyhow, I was washing cars downtown, and the old man that watched us was a pretty good old man. I told him, I said, if you let me get up to the bank, I can bail out of this thing. And he says, okay, I'll walk you up at noon. Well, we walked up there at noon, and I told the lady I didn't have my account number with me and went on through all that junk. And she said, let me go look. She came back in a few minutes, Mr. Oakley, not only is your account depleted, there's 12 pieces of paper for which we have no money. Something I'd never done before in my life. I'd never hung a piece of paper on anybody. But you see, in a blackout, I'd start hanging some. And I hung 12 pieces on somebody. So now I couldn't get out of jail on account of the check charge was worse than what I was in for. Again, I listened to this man, and after he got through one night talking to us, I called him aside and started crying to him about my situation. That I was close to get, I could get out if close to it anyhow, if he would just probably give me a little money or something, take care of these checks. And he says, no, he says, haven't you got a retirement check in there yet? I said, well, I should have one into the bank. And he says, well, he said, tell you what you do. You have old man Red take you up there, get some money. And as these drunks get out, give them enough for a beer or two and tell them to go to Oak Ridge Tavern, one of those lovely places I like to go to, you know. And he says, see if you owe them some money. And if you do, tell them you want to pay them back. I tried that, and it worked. I bought 11 of the 12 pieces of paper while I was still in jail. So then I was pretty free to get out, I thought. A year later, I found out where the other piece of paper was at and was able to buy it back and clean up that mess. I continued to listen to that man, though, the whole time he was there. What night he didn't come out, a guy named Ed Jellison came out. Ed was about 6'4", retired, 30-year infantry colonel, crew-cut hair, black shoes. The only thing he took off was a shirt. Everything else was still military, and that's the way he did the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's who I ended up with as my first sponsor in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going through the steps. This was another beautiful thing that happened to me, as they do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The place I went to after I got out of jail was a wino group downtown. Very few women would come there. If they did, they'd come at noon. Hardly any would ever come there at night because of the location and the smell of the place itself, because it usually smelled of something, and sometimes it wasn't very pleasant either. But anyhow, I encountered men in whom the problem had been solved, and that's exactly what I needed. I didn't need anything else. I didn't need to be powder puffed by anybody. I didn't need to be handed a $10 bill or be told how sorry they felt for me. And I was glad of that. And they believed in the steps there. And so I started through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with this colonel. Of course, he knew one way to do it, 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's the only thing I knew was 1, 2, 3, 4 after coming out of the military. But of course, I told the usual lies and all that sort of thing, but I did manage to get through the steps. The beautiful things that happened to me during this interim was really outstanding. Not only did I meet Charlie Lindenwood, the Arkansas traveler with 52 years, which was to be my spiritual advisor some years down the road, but I met Clarence Snyder, whose story's in the big book, The Home Brewmeister, and he was of the original 100. And Clarence knew the program of Alcoholics Anonymous up and down. I, in fact, when I was going to California, and I picked up the book, Good Old Timers, and I started to read it, and I thought, I've read this book. You know, I knew so many of the names and everything. It was from sitting with Clarence and going through all these things. He knew who went to Chicago and started a meeting, and who went to St. Louis and all that sort of thing. So I spent actually hours and hours with Clarence Snyder, and he was a beautiful man. If he'd drop everything to help a new man, he didn't care if he just walked through the door yesterday, Clarence would go and help him. And like I say, at that time, I don't remember how many years, but he was number 41 out of the 100. And so I had a lot of good help along the way, and I made the usual mistakes the rest of us do. But the thing is that I had this strength around me. I'm one of these people that believes that you come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to fulfill your dreams. In fact, I say bring your dreams to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even bring your drunken dreams to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And get with this person you call a sponsor. I know everybody here has got a sponsor too. I don't have to worry about it. You know, okay. And you get with a sponsor and you go over the list. Well, you really don't need a fur coat, you know. You could use a job at the dime store or the hamburger joint or something. But anyhow, make out this list. I don't care what's on it, really. That's your business. I made out one because it was a thing to do then. Put anything on it you want. And so I filled out this dream list and went to work on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I say, one of my dreams was I had this no education at all, no formal education at all. So I always wanted an education. And of course I wanted a college education. And finally an old man stopped me one morning, old man Bill. He was a Harvard grad. He slept upstairs in the club. He stopped me and says, "Come here, dummy." And I went over and I said, "Yeah, Bill, what do you want?" He was always on me, always. I said, "What do you want, Bill?" And he says, "I want you to quit talking about the school thing or shut up." And I sang our national anthem. I said, "But you don't understand." And he says, "What don't I understand?" I said, "I don't have a high school diploma." He says, "Good, dummy. That's where you start. Can't start from where you ain't. Three or four things you need to know about any alcoholic, and don't care how old he is, how long he's been around the program, or anything else. He always wants to start from where he ain't." Oh, yeah. He's the best in the world at mind reading and fortune telling. If you think not, listen to somebody that's ready to take a ninth step. I know when I see her, she'll say this, but I'll say that. She's in Oklahoma. He's still in Florida. Huh? Hadn't seen her in 20 years. You know what the best thing you can do with a ninth step? Just pray. A very simple prayer. God, let her have an open mind as I approach this thing. And let me be as honest as I can possibly be as I take this ninth step. And you'll be surprised how people sort of change around. And you talk to them after they come by and say, "Well, how'd it go?" "Well, my God, she did this, she did that." Al Vernon and I had just gotten married. And Al Vernon's a few years younger than me. And we were to go to Boston to, the grandchild was to be born. And this would be my first occasion to see this wife of earlier years, who had some choice words for me when we parted. Anyhow, we would go to Boston, and so up there, all the way up there, in fact, I was telling Al Vernon, "She can be a real bitch. Oh, she can do this. And she, oh, you want, boy, you, she do. Oh, she does. Oh, duh." Anyhow, we get up to Lowell, Mass. Never been there before. You finally find the hospital, and we get ready to wheel the van in to park. And here comes a little foreign car and pulls in there, and a rather graying lady gets out of it and says, "Bill Oakley, before you can open your big mouth, I want you to know how much we think and appreciate what you're doing with your life today. Here's this bitch." Next thing I know, she's telling out, they're laughing, the two of them, Al Vernon, this. And the next thing she's saying out, "Look, I know you guys are camping, but if it rains tonight, come over to my place. Got plenty of room. Be glad to have you. Come anyhow. It don't have to rain. Really want you." Mind reading and fortune telling. Still gets me in more trouble than anything in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know why? Because a lot of times I think it's my business in this thing. And it's not. It's God's business. And separating what's God's business and what's my business is one of my major jobs today. And more important than that, if it's God's business, what am I doing fooling with it? And if it's mine, what am I going to do about it? And I don't want to hear. And what I don't want to really hear is, when am I going to do it? Big problem for me today. But on that ninth step, that simple prayer, "God, please her, have her open mind. Have her have an open mind and accept me in the way that this thing is to be presented and all." Works. Works. I had to change sponsors a couple of, I know everybody here has got a sponsor too. Yeah. Everybody's worked the third step. Ain't nobody here on the third step. Huh? No. Okay. Boy, that's good. As a rule, somebody say, "I am." I always like to find out how you can be on it. It's a decision. It's either made or it isn't. And the book says, to establish the third step, you must follow it immediately. It don't say 10 days or 2 weeks. It says immediately, with a house cleaning. And the house cleaning starts with the inventory. So, I'm sort of a sticker for steps. I believe in sponsoring, as I mentioned before. I believe in taking the steps no more than 2 weeks. No more than 2 weeks. That's plenty of time. This Clarence Snyder I mentioned to you before took him, would take you through the steps in 2 days. 2 days, he'd ring you out too. But I think 2 weeks is long enough because they work and all that. And sometimes there's a little time difference there, and we'll have to stretch it maybe for a day or two, but I don't see any reason in the world for being more than 2 weeks on the steps. The steps themselves don't establish any firm time. But that word immediately means now. And then it tells you what to do after you take the steps and go to the fifth step and all that. Take this book down from the shelf and see how you're done. You know, it doesn't really say, well, wait 30 minutes. I've had people take step a year. My God, rigor mortis will set in before then. Then, of course, the fourth step is the one. I wish people would quit sitting around, standing around, or sitting around the rooms talking about how bad the fourth step is. If first place, you see where it gives the diagram on how it is. I am mad at Mr. Brown, so forth and so on. You know the columns in the book. They miss this word. I am. I am means now. It does say I used to be or I'm going to be. It says I am. So when I take the inventory, what do? I take those things that bother me about me right now. Right now. You say, oh, but I'll think of some others later. Sure you will. That's why we got other steps too. But an inventory is a thing that happens right now. I like six or seven things at least. And then we go, and another thing is you think, well, I did this. I'm not going to tell them about that. I ain't going to put that down. Well, if it's got a name, it's been done before. And chances are you didn't assign the nomenclature. No, you're not the originator. Not by a long shot. I don't care what it is either. Put it down there. You're going to put it down somewhere. This same boy I was telling you about had 16 years, did 16 years in Ohio State for killing a boy. When we went over his stepway, told me about this and all, he says, for God's sakes, Bill, don't ever tell anybody I did that. I said, of course I won't. Not supposed to. I said, but you will. I chaired the Sunday morning meeting for 10 or 12 years at the old Central Group. And sure enough, one Sunday morning we were in there, and sure enough, he had the need to tell somebody that because somebody in that room needed to hear it. And he blurbed it right out. I did 16 years in Ohio State for killing a man in a blackout. I said, well, well. Yeah, we need to tell these things. Like I say, I believe in sponsoring. And if you haven't got a sponsor, get one. And for God's sakes, get a sponsor that's got a sponsor. If you don't, you're talking to two damn fools, you and him. Yeah. Now, like I said, to start with, it's like the college professors that have different angles that we go at this thing, different approaches and all that. I believe my job as a sponsor is to become obsolete. I sincerely believe that. I'm to take you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, tell you how to chair a meeting, maybe listen to your first talk, and then I don't care whether you speak to me again or not. That's not my affair. Quite often, though, I'll become your confidant and friend for some great number of years. But the thing of sponsorship as such is over with as far as I'm concerned, once you've gotten the 12 steps. Of course, I've got some guys that have still call me sponsor for word. I call it spiritual advisor. It don't make a hell of a lot of difference what you call it. But I remain a friend. I answer questions to them all the time when I can. But when I had Charlie, I had to go to Charlie. I had one that you think, well, you've been in enough years, you probably had it all. No, I had one not too many years ago, and he made dirty phone calls when he was drunk. Yeah. That's the only time he made them. So I never had one do that before. I never had heard of it. So I went to call Charlie. I says, Charlie, I says, this guy makes nasty phone calls when he's drunk. And I says, what should he do about it? Go and see the people or what? And he says, no. He says, I think I'd leave well enough alone, Oakley, as long as he's sober. If he gets drunk again, he ain't going to be able to do anything about it anyhow. And he'll start doing it again. But just to call that family and get them all upset, well, I've quit. I ain't ever going to call it again. He didn't think that was going to work. Anyhow, the guy got drunk again anyhow. And it might be because he liked making dirty phone calls. I don't know. But, you know, all the nuts ain't in the fruitcase. No. And ain't it wonderful? We all don't go crazy at one time. Oh, boy, I'm telling you. So But, you know, the thing that really gets me, I guess, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I sit there and I see a new person come in. And I wait for the meeting to break up. And I see who moves. And here we get in our little cliques. And we're talking about Jane. And we're talking about going to the hot dog roast next week and getting the car fixed or kids' teeth fixed or something like that. And this poor guy's starting toward the door. And nobody has stopped him. Nobody has stopped him. I don't know what we're afraid of. We think this old drunk's going to hurt us or something, you know. I think it's more ego than anything in the world attached to that kind of thinking. Because if you really think about it, when you go to help that man, you're about your father's business. It ain't your business at all. You're about your father's business. And that's what you do before you go talk to a fresh drunk. Or you go help one. God help me say the right things to this man. And he will. He gives everyone that little voice. Every one of you. I don't care if you've been here 2 days. Ain't got nothing to do with it. If you've been here 2 days, you're better off than he is. So you tell him, I've only been here 2 days. Let me take you up here and talk to this man here. He's been here 3 years, they tell me. So you can do that to him. He'll remember it. But you all got that little voice. Every one of you. God gives it to you when you're going about his business. It's like this boy was robbing one of these wall safes, you know, and it had a little old pen light, and he put that light up there and was trying, and he heard a little voice, and a little voice says, Jesus sees you. In the heck? So he stopped what he was doing, took the light and extended it around the room, and he didn't see anything, so he went back to work on the safe, you know, and the little voice says, Jesus doesn't like what you're doing. He stepped out just a little further. Still didn't see anything in the room. Stepped back, you know, and went back to work on his safe. And the little voice says, Jesus will punish you. He stopped. Walked all the way around the room. Got over here in the corner. And there's a little old green parrot standing on a stick-like thing, you know. And he says, oh, hell, what could a little old green parrot do? But as his light fell away, there was a great Doberman standing there and had his ears up and his teeth blared. And the little boy says, sick him, Jesus. He gives you that little voice. Believe me, he does. Just remember whose business you're about and it'll come out all right. Always does. But the thing of sponsorship, and that's really what I think's wrong with AA today, that among clubs and drugs, but I'm sorry, I missed that one. I shouldn't have. The thing is that you can't sponsor somebody and take him through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or at least the way I do, I take them down. I tell them, first off, we got an agreement. Huh? We're going to do this thing in 2 weeks. Now, if you object to that for some reason or another, fine, get you somebody else. I got plenty of things to do, and I need to be doing them. But if you agree to it, then that's what I want. Well, if you have some extenuating circumstances, I can go along with that. I'm not that hard, but let's do this thing in 2 weeks and get it over with and get you sober. So, I established that right off. And then the next thing I do for them, I said, there's 63 pages in this book I want you to read. I want you to go through every word of those 63 pages. Why? Because I believe this. Well established in those 63 pages. Well established, well grounded in the words of those 63 pages goes so much towards the rest of the program. So much. It carries an awful lot of weight into the rest of the program. Be weak there and forget the rest of it. It'll be weak too. Be weak in those first three. Anyhow, I want him to go over that. And I tell him to underline anything he wants to, any word, any chapter or anything else. I don't care because my book's underlined. And then we sit down and we go through that word for word. And if he hasn't got any questions, I got some. And then I turn him loose on the fourth step. And like I say, I expect about seven or eight things, I don't care. Because you see, the real powerhouse is in the fifth step. And a lot of times I'd rather hear your story than I would the inventory. I know about how the inventory is going to run. But I want to hear your story for one reason. There's two things. There's an inventory and there's a story. He says we sit down for a long time and all that sort of thing. That story lets me, when we're going through other businesses, we go down through the path of sobriety, lets me see other things that are going on with you. Well, like something will happen, I'll say, well, that's just like you did in the third grade. You told me you did this and you did that. You're doing the same thing. Huh? He doesn't realize it. But the story's important to me. The inventory, okay, what the heck? You could probably sit down and write anybody's inventory in a hurry. But to get into the fifth step. And that's why it takes so long to do. I think because you bring in, you hit these things, you know. And this one guy I was talking to, well, been a year or two ago now. He asked me to take him on, so I did. And he'd been in and out of the program. And we were talking about his resentments. And he says, well, this one kid, he says, I said, well, who is he? He's not even related to you or anything. Who is he? He says, well, I tell you, when I lived up there in Virginia, that kid kept me on the street and beat the hell out of me every time he came close to me. And I hated his guts and still do. I says, that's when you was a kid, huh? You're 50 years old now, aren't you? When's the last time you seen him? Oh, hell, I haven't been back to Virginia, and I didn't see him then. I guess 30 years or so. He's been living rent-free in your head for 30 years, and you don't even know whether he's alive or dead. There are more resentments over dead people than the law allows. Huh? And you talk about a dumb situation. That's a dumb situation. Somebody's taking up all that space here when I could be giving a little more thought to God, as I should be, over something I don't know a damn thing about. Is he still alive? I don't know. Maybe he don't even live there anymore. Maybe he became a preacher or something. I don't know. Yeah. 30 years since he's even seen the guy. Even been back in the damn town. So anyhow, and going through those things again and again and again, well, of course it has to make you look at your own program. And mine needs looking at, I can assure you, on a continuous basis. But that's one thing that helps me with, too. Because you just can't sponsor somebody unless that does have an effect on your own program. I had a kid named Richard one time. He came into the central group, and I jumped him just as soon as he came in the door. Because by that time, I had my teeth fixed in a Timex, and I thought I was well, you know. I thought I ought to join the holy men. And, man, I'd get me one right now and start to work on him. Anyhow, I was sorry I grabbed Richard. Because Richard was, he didn't even know whether he was here or not, to tell you the truth. Richard was the kind, I'd say, well, meeting's starting here in about 5 minutes. Let's go ahead and get us a seat, Richard. I says, go to the bathroom first. He says, you reckon I should? I said, for Christ's sake, go and try then, Richard. And he'd come out of the bathroom, be grinning, and he'd say, you're right. I said, Lord, Lord, please help me. I wish I hadn't jumped on this one. Well, somehow his sister out in California found out about him. And she sent him some money and all that, and he went to California. And I was relieved of it. I said, oh, boy, boy, boy. Well, I don't know. Clancy or one of the California gurus got a hold of him. And sure enough, he got sober out there. And he went to work and was working at the same place for 3 or 4 years. And I was down at the old central group one time, and I looked across the room. I said, damn, I know that boy over there. I know him. Damn, why did I know him? After the meeting was over, he came over towards me. He says, you know who I am? I said, yeah, you're Richard, aren't you? And he says, yeah. I says, I'll be darned. He says, I've had the same job for 4 years. He said, I rode a bus across the country just to see the country. Not that I had money to fly and all, but he said, I rode that bus because I just wanted to. And I thought, boy, ain't it amazing? You just don't know how these things are going to turn out. And maybe you're not the answer. Don't get your feelings hurt if some guy tells you he's going to change sponsors or something like that. Might work better with somebody else. And by the same token, we haven't got the answers for everybody. No, there's other ways to get sober. This has been the best way for me, though, this way here. But in thinking of Richard, there was this kid riding a tricycle down through the park. And he hit a crack in the sidewalk, and went head over heels, turned his, tore his tricycle all up, the wheel was all bent, and his knee was scratched and bleeding and all that. And he got up and he says, "I'd be a son of a bitch." And there was a preacher over there on the bench reading his book. And he got up and he says, "Son, you should never do that again. If you ever have a problem like that again, you say, 'Praise God.'" Same scenario, 2 or 3 weeks later, kid's prowling down through the park there with his tricycle and hits that crack, head over heels. He goes, sure enough, the tricycle wheel's all bent, his knees scarred and everything, and he gets up and he says, "I'll be a..." And he looked over there and there was the preacher and he says, "Praise God." And he looked down, the tricycle wheel was straight and his knee wasn't torn anymore. He jumped on the tricycle, went down through the park, and the preacher come off the bench and says, "I'll be a son of a bitch." Verna hates that story. Anyhow, I know we all need to check out of this place today, but I started with that thing of bringing your dreams to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very sincere about that. Make that list. Make an honest application of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to 1 year. 1 year is all I ask. Then I guarantee you, you'll have the things on the list. Or maybe the Cadillac you thought you needed, you got replaced by a Ford truck or something. But here's the amazing thing about it. You'll have more than what you had on the list. Guarantee it. I don't have a dream that hadn't been fulfilled since I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you I had no formal education. And the old man says, "Well, that's where you start." So I went down there and I took the exam that they offered me. I knew I wanted to be an artist of some kind. I thought I knew what I wanted. And sure enough, the test came out that way. And so I went out to the university there in Central Florida to the art department to enroll. And I told them I wanted to study ceramics, mosaics rather, which of course is part of the ceramic thing. And he said, "Well, we just don't have anybody to teach you that, Mr. Oakley. How about sculpting or something like that?" I said, "Well, at least I'll be in the art department and I'll see maybe something else I want to do." So for 4 years I went to school and ended up throwing a lot of pots and doing a lot of other things. I never did find anybody to teach me what I really went to learn. But I learned an awful lot of philosophy and thoroughly enjoyed 4 years out there. It takes that long to get an education, incidentally, if you go to the university. I thought it'd get there quicker than that, you know, but no, it takes a little while. Had to learn something there, too. I was having a problem with the first 6 months I went. So I went to the Navy to see an old Navy chief there that ran the alcohol program for the Navy there in Orlando. And I talked to Ken and told him what my problem was, how I was having a hell of a time out there at school and all. And he says, "Do me a favor. Go to school and become Bill Oakley student. Not Bill Oakley alcoholic, not Bill Oakley grandfather, not Bill Oakley anything else but student. That's all." And sure enough, I tried that. And pretty soon I'd sit in the coffee shop with the kids and I'd say, "Did you get Dr. So-and-so's program yesterday? I missed it. I just didn't get it." And sure enough, they'd be telling me things and I'd be learning things, you know. We sometimes curse the word teacher here in the rooms of they say, "Oh, he's a preacher or a teacher." Well, a teacher is nothing more than one who passes on information. Everyone in this room is a teacher or has been to somebody else. So don't condemn or think that's some kind of funny word that shouldn't be used. Teacher is a good word, just one who passes on information. So anyhow, where was I at, Alberta? I don't know. Bringing your dreams. So anyhow, I thoroughly enjoyed those 4 years. In fact, I finished a degree in art and had some time left on a GI Bill. And I thought, boy, I'm having such a kick out here. I was roofing houses, incidentally, the two days a week I wasn't at school. I was carrying 16 hours. But anyhow, I was having such a good time, I transferred to sociology. Oh, God. Everybody I ran into was going to be a savior of some kind. But anyhow, I just need 16 or 18 hours for a degree in sociology. Don't want it, but the dream's been fulfilled. Wanted to be an auctioneer. Am an auctioneer. Been one for years. I don't do much with it anymore unless it's charity type thing, but I can do it. In fact, when I left school up there, I was voted best all around. And so another dream has been fulfilled. Now, I was a kid and we were so poor, they stole a great big tent, half as big as this room. I don't know where they stole it from or anything. I didn't ask. It was questions you didn't ask anyhow. But they took it down on the Kentucky River and set it up right on that white beach sand they had there, and sort of lived off the land. That means they stole for a living. Spent the summer down there. Boy, I really enjoyed it. Because I could sit out there at night and you could almost hear that river, you know, gurgle like. And nobody was beating on me or hollering at me or cussing me or anything like that. And I always remembered that. And that was one thing I was going to do, is have me a house on the river. Well, when you're sucking on a wine jug, it's pretty hard to get a mortgage of any kind, you know. So it never came about. Al Vernon and I got married, and we moved to a little place in Orlando. And I didn't want to move. I said, well, I'm pretty satisfied with where I'm at. Had a little antique shop up on Michigan Avenue and everything. Was able to live in it and all. But anyhow, she wanted us to move and thought we should. And there were several reasons for it. But anyhow, I said, no, I don't want to go. Well, she was serious about it. Well, we moved down there. And sure enough, it was on a little old lake. A beautiful little old lake. And I cleaned out all the stuff in front of the dock there and made a dock so you could sit out there and enjoy it and all that sort of thing. Fed the fish and all that. And a few years later, Al Vernon says, I think we ought to see about something else. And I said, oh, God, you know, I don't want to leave my water. It's just what I've always wanted. And so a little later, she says, I want you to go down to Narcoosee and look at this place. I said, Narcoosee, Florida? She says, yeah. I says, Al Vernon, nobody lives in Narcoosee, got any damn sense at all. She said, well, I'd like for you to go look at this place. Well, I wasn't too set on it, but I finally went down and looked at it. And had a nice big barn on it, double-wide mobile home, just 12 and a half acres. And she says, I think we ought to get this. And I was a bit hesitant. I hadn't even walked all over the place yet, but I was hesitant. And all of a sudden, I looked over there, and there's what they call down there a cattle hole. They just dig a big hole in the ground, and the water comes in, and the cattle come over there and drink. So there was a cattle hole, and it was full of water. So we bought the place, and I got to live by the water again. But now as things get along, you know, and I'm getting older, and I can't do the things I'd like to do very well, a lot of them, too. But anyhow, we've had to sell the place and move into town. And so it's adjustment time again. But, you know, years ago I was down in Florida listening to a lady. And I asked her after the meeting was over. I says, you seem so aware of God. Why can't I get that sort of thing? What am I doing? She said, well, I use things to stimulate me in that area. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I use car horns or bells. Anytime I hear a bell or a car horn, I think of God. And I thought, well, that's good, you know, because there's plenty of horns going off and plenty of bells around, you know. And that would add to you. And I tried birds for a while, and they drove me nuts. I was, you know, here'd come a bird. Anyhow, I got over that thing. And I finally decided that I'd get me a God tree. And so I planted the tree on it, a dry stick, dry root, we call it. That's what it looks like, just a straight stick, no root on it or anything. Anyhow, it was a cypress, and I planted it, and that was my God tree. So every time I walk around the place, I'd see my God tree, and it would make me a little more God conscious. Well, we had to move to town, like I told you, and so I'd planted some trees in a nursery out there, and I took one of them out as the first thing I did to the new place, and I planted me a God tree right in the front yard. So I still got me a God tree, but I had to give up my water. But that's what life's all about. Life is what happens when you're planning on something else. One day chicken, next day feathers. I don't care who you are, that's the way life goes down. For all of us, yeah. One day chicken, next day feathers. This has been an exciting time for me. I've had just a wonderful time in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some beautiful things have happened to me and some tragic things too, of course. But again, that's life. You know, I hate to see people come in here with what I call the Reader's Digest syndrome. That's where you come in, you know, and a week later you're going to ride off into the sunset of happy, happy sobriety, you know. Never to be faced with the contingencies of everyday living again, you know, like paying the rent. No, oh, no, I'm going to be fine. No, that ain't the way life goes. I don't like to see that, and I try to take it out. I don't mind the pink cloud business. I believe that's true. I believe you can stay on a pink cloud as long as you want to, too. But anyhow, there has been a lot of excitement, a lot of wonderful things have happened to me. A tremendous amount of people. God knows. There's just a whole host of beautiful men and women that helped this idiot get up to this podium. I'm telling you. And I often reflect on that, too. And how many different walks of life they came from and all that sort of thing. Everything from preachers to full bird colonels and all that sort of thing. Anyhow, that's been a wonderful part of it, too. There's a lot of richness to my life today that there wasn't before. There's a lot of love in my life today that there wasn't before. I can tell a man I love him today, and it don't bother me at all, you know. In fact, Ed Jowson once told me one time, says, go put your arm around that old boy over there and tell him you love him. I said, Ed, he stinks. He says, you didn't. Yeah, you didn't. So that's in my life today, too. There's the excitement of that new tomorrow, the challenge of it. There's a God in my life today that I never had before. But you know, with all the richness, with all the happiness, with all the love, with the challenge of that new tomorrow, the excitement of God, I better remember one thing. It'll all be taken away with a single drink. Thank you.